Hi, I'm Moon Unit Zappa, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcasts.
Welcome to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party, a Pantheon podcast. Look inside the, let the sound take you away. Music. Girl, we couldn't get much higher. Culture. Conversation.
Hey, the tambourine man, play a song for me.
And good old-fashioned rock and roll.
Excuse me while I kiss this.
So now, I give you Miss Pamela and her pajama party.
Hello, dolls. Pamela DeBar here. You know, I do love my last name. It's real pretty. It's better than Miller. I got it from my ex-husband, Michael DeBar, and I've decided to keep it forever. Anyway, I am Pamela DeBar, your host today. You are listening to a Pantheon podcast, and I'm very happy to be part of that team. We have so many great musical podcasts for you to listen to, so check them all out. And today I have, I don't know how to introduce this lady. She's my goddaughter, my only goddaughter. I've known her since she was a little over a year old. So this is pretty amazing. I think the only person I've known a little longer is Moon Zappa. I met her when she was about 6 months old. So here today we have Polly Parsons. She is Graham Parsons' only child and, my darling girl for over 50 years. So it's a big thrill to have her here. And her life story is unbelievable. I've been trying to get her to write her memoir forever, and she will one day. And it's going to be a humdinger. But you get to hear some tidbits from her today. So let's welcome Polly Parsons.
There used to be a gambler who courted all around. There used to be a gambler, he courted all around. He courted pretty Polly, such beauty never been found. Pretty Polly, come go along with me. Pretty Polly, come go along with me. Before we get married, some pleasures to see.
All right. I have here with me someone who is so precious to me. It's indescribable, and I am a writer, but I have known her entire life, minus about a year and 4 months. I met her when she was barely walking, and today we have here with us Polly Parsons, my beloved Graham Parsons' daughter, and I met her when she was a baby, and I was so thrilled to meet her. Her dad called me up. I had just moved into my first apartment. And I got a phone call. That's when you actually picked up the phone all the time. If it rang, you had to pick it up. And there were no phone machines or anything. So I picked it up and it was Graham. And he said, my girlfriend, my lady, I think he said, Nancy is in town with our baby Polly. And I'm wondering if you could babysit for us tonight where I'm going to take Nancy out. And it was like one of the most amazing moments, life-changing really. That I can recall, because first of all, he was going to trust me with his baby, which meant I was a family. I felt part of the family member, right? And I got to go hang out up at the burrito house for hours, and which I did quite often after that. Chris and Graham had just moved into this big new house on Nichols Canyon on La Castaña, and it was a big ranch house with a big fireplace. So I went up there, hung out, met Nancy, Polly's mother, and hung out with them for a little bit. And then he took her out. And I was there with this little baby. And I'd only been around the Zappa children. I really was not around kids much. And I remember saying in my book, this is one baby I really wanted to get to know. So today we have Polly with us. And I've known her all her whole life. That's pretty amazing to say, right?
It absolutely is amazing to say. And what a life it's been. I mean, as crazy as my life has been growing up and being blessed enough to ask you to be my godmother has been one of the greatest gifts of my life. But as crazy as my life has been, yours has been fabulous and amazing and awe-inspiring. And I feel like the luckiest girl in the world, to be honest. So it's an absolute pleasure to join you and say hi to everybody out there. And I'm just really, really, really grateful to be here.
Polly's story is so incredible. I've been trying to get her to write a book, but and you know, she's got a lot of notes and things, but she hasn't actually sat down to write this book yet. However, in a little while, I'm going to ask her to read a piece that she wrote in the very first writing workshop she came to in Austin, and it was at her house. And I have a big group of writers in Austin, and almost all of them were weeping. Am I right? When you finished reading that? And I had
I had never written anything in my entire life. And that sounds silly and cliche, but it's actual fact.
So
it was shocking because I have no idea. I had no idea until that moment that there's actually a different spirit that comes through when you literally put pen to paper.
Yes.
Like you gave us permission and you prompted us not to edit or think. And so right. I just did those two things and I
followed the rules right away.
Yeah. I understood the assignment.
Yes. And she completed this assignment. And there were probably 15 or 16 of us that night and no one spoke afterwards. It was like, what just happened? Anyway, she's going to read that in a little bit, but while I'm on this topic, I'm going to invite people to my writing workshops. I have writing workshops on Zoom and all over the place. So if you're interested in them, all you fabulous listeners, you know, find me on my website, PamelaDeBarOfficial.com, and I will get back to you about it.
Can I just say something real quick?
Yeah, of course.
I am in the house right now doing this podcast with you from Austin, Texas.
Yep.
And Daddy just came on the radio.
What song?
That's all I took. That's all it took.
That's all it took. Oh, the mention of your name.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wow. I don't even know where to start with you.
We call that Graham magic.
Yes, it happens a lot, right?
It does happen a lot. It happens whenever moments like this happen. He always pokes in and says, "Hi, I'm here."
I know. You know, he is a present spirit because I've lost so many friends, right? I mean, I've reached the ripe old age of 73. So I've lost a lot of people, a lot of loved ones, but not all of them are present like he is, because I feel him all the time.
Right. I do too.
And of course you would, but I talk to him, you know, I speak to him a lot. And mm-hmm. I promised him after he passed away, which was hell, I went to Joshua Tree, first of many, many, many trips, and slept in the room he died in and sent him all this healing, love, energy, and light and all that stuff. And I promised him that night I would perpetuate his music.
Mm.
And it's something I really believe I've done that.
I really believe you have done that. And I think that's really, I have to just acknowledge you for a second. I know there's many of us that have had people in our lives that have passed on, and to have the presence of mind to take a moment and drive hours to go pay respect and send love and actually be in the space of where that person left this planet. Just the fact that you had the presence of mind to set forth and carry through that intention,
yes,
I think says a lot, not only about who you are, but really is a beautiful reminder of how even when we lose people and we aren't able to be there during their passing, that however we carry out the next phase of remembrance or honoring is and can be a lifetime of potency just in that one effort. And it doesn't have to be anything complicated. It can just be doing exactly what you did. And I always love remembering that literally within days of his passing, you just got in the car and went and communed with him in the only way or in the best way that you could in the moment that you had. And I just want you to know that has always been with me.
Thank you, honey. Well, you and I went and stayed in room 8.
So you brought me there for the very first time. And I had never gone before. I did not heal, quite honestly. I did not heal the trauma of my father's death till I was in my 30s. I denied it and stuffed it and drank it and drugged it to the point in order to avoid having to do the work. And with that, you know, when I finally did feel like I trusted someone enough, which was you, I allowed myself to go to Joshua Tree and stay in that room with you. And then for years after that, it felt like coming home. And people ask me about this and they say, oh, don't you think it's morbid that anybody would stay in that room? And I'm like, I don't know what to tell you. All I know is that it feels like the guest room at my father's home. Like it feels like the guest room of like his home in Laurel Canyon. Like I feel him there, not necessarily in the room. I feel him at Cap Rock strongest.
Yes. The presence of, he loved it there. He was his favorite place to be. Exactly. So it doesn't matter if he passed on there. He also lived fully there.
Exactly. And it gives me, like, the little girl inside me finds comfort that there is an actual place I can go to.
Yes.
And check in.
Yeah. You know, it took me 40 years or whatever to go to his actual grave because I knew he didn't want to be there.
Right. You
know, that's not where he wanted to be. He did want to be in Joshua Tree. And that wild Phil Kaufman, you know, tried to, you know, make his wishes come true by taking him out there, setting his body on fire, the casket and all that stuff, which people play up too much, right? I mean, you must agree with that.
Okay. I'll give you that. But I have to ask you, how can you not play that up? It is an up thing.
Well, it did happen.
His best friend brought him out to the desert and made him into a literal bonfire.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how people through the years have said, wasn't he, he's the guy whose body was burned out in the desert. That's what I mean by playing it. That's, you know, yeah. And when he passed on, because he was not very well known.
That's
what they talked about, and it was
okay. But what do you prefer they talk about?
His music. I was hoping, and which it did, cause attention to him. Yeah.
So, I think that Graham went out exactly the way he was supposed to. I think that he loves all of the fanfare and bonfire magic. I think that it's important to remember now that all of that craziness has happened, and thank you very much, it has introduced millions of people to his music. That flash in the night has brought true listeners and true fans to his music through that crazy story. So I'm down with it.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important for me to remind the world of the magic he created in such a short time. He knew exactly what he was doing within a six or seven year span. The amount of music that he put out into the world was like he was on a mission and he was in a hurry. And I will never stop feeling that. He knew he wasn't here for long, and he had a lot of work to do in a very short time, and he went out the way he came in.
I agree. And I'm not demeaning that experience at all.
At all. I don't think you are. Yeah.
No. And I went to the eulogy, and I still have the t-shirt and the beer bottle, the Graham Pilsner stuff.
You know, I feel about that whole party and the whole Phil Kaufman thing the way you feel about the burning of the Phil Kaufman and the burning of the coffin in Joshua Tree. For some reason, I'm down with that. That's very rock and roll, and I love it. The whole making money to pay for, I don't know how I feel about all that.
Well, he was trying to make money just to pay for his and Michael's, you know, the roadie who was helping him take the body to the desert. They got in big trouble. So that was to pay their attorney fees and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I think deep down I knew that, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah, that's what it was for. But it was morbid. It was a little morbid, but I was there for Phil. I wanted to go, but you know, he had that guy who sings the Monster Mash there, and he sang the Monster Mash. So he was trying to make it into, I don't know, almost.
You know, to be funny about it. And let me ask you a serious question here. I have reached out in very sad, sad times to Phil Kaufman to try to fill in gaps of my life and my relation to my father, because all I know as the daughter of Graham Parsons, large amounts of what I know are not the things that matter, but are the parts I've had to fill in. And he has not been willing to talk to me ever, ever. And it breaks my heart.
I know.
And I don't understand. And finally, someone said to me, well, you know, he says you're not Graham's daughter.
Exactly.
And I'm like, okay, that's fine when I was little, if you're not sure, you know, whatever. I mean, I have my birth certificate. I know my father's sick, whatever. But now you can look at me and my child, and if you
can't see
Graham Parsons, then you're just certifiably insane. So what's the excuse now is my question.
I think he knows he fucked up, and when he wrote in the book that you weren't his child, and he's embarrassed. He would never admit that.
Or maybe I'm just being a little girl about it, you know, and maybe I shouldn't care. Like, of course he doesn't want to talk to me. Who cares if he doesn't want to talk to me? Why does it matter so much? And I'll tell you why in my humanness it mattered, because for whatever reason, I didn't have parents, right? Dad died, and my mom mentally checked out the second my dad died. So I was out here in the wilderness, and I guess I thought of Emmylou and Phil like an aunt and uncle.
Yeah,
to be honest.
Well, that does make sense. It does make sense. Unfortunately, you and I lost touch for a while. And that, you know, one of my regrets, but it was impossible to find you, was that I wasn't there for you during your early teen years, you know, those years.
Oh, I was a hellion. You would have been so over me so fast.
No, I would have been able to help you during that very difficult time, which I finally did. We reconnected. Well, first I lost touch after your father died. Your mom disappeared. You were raised in boxcars and shit. I mean, it's unbelievable, your story. So it has to be told. But because your mother thought she was, even though he was married to Gretchen and now in love with Emmylou Harris, she thought she was going to get him back. She always believed he would come back. So when he couldn't come back and checked out completely, that's when she had a mental breakdown, which continued through the years and made your childhood absolute hell. But it also created who you are today. This amazing woman, you know, such an entrepreneur. And so I have total faith in you. It's like, oh, Polly, oh, no, she can do anything. And I really believe that. But it was hard. I know how hard it was. And so I saw you once after your father had only been gone about a year, right, at the Renaissance Fair, where, and you were all dressed up like a little gypsy. There's a really fabulous photo of you from that time frame, dressed up like a little gypsy. And I recognized you, and I hadn't seen you since you were about two and a half or something. And you were eight or nine there, nine maybe. And I went, oh my God, is your name Polly? I can still see it. It was so cute. And you took me to see your mom, and I could see she was pretty spaced out. And that's the last I saw you until, who told you about the book? Somebody told you I'd written about you in the book, right?
Somebody called me. I was literally like 21 going on 12.
Yes.
And somebody called me and said, I'm reading this book, and this lady said that she used to be your babysitter. And I was like, what? And she read me the passage of your book where you talk mm-hmm. about babysitting little Polly. Mm-hmm. And you talked about my eyes and how much you loved Graham and Nancy. And I was like, she's talking about things that no one would know unless yeah. she was there.
Yes,
and so of course I called my mother and I was like, who is this woman? Why don't I know who she is? Why did you never tell me about her? What is this? And she goes, oh yeah, that's Miss Pamela. She was a big part of our lives when you were a child and she used to babysit you. And I was like, well, thanks for that. And I hung up and I thought to myself, how am I going to find this woman? And so I wrote a letter to your publisher.
Yeah.
And I said, I know you don't know who I am, but if this doesn't sound too crazy, I would love to know if this is true. And if it is, could you please tell Miss Pamela that I reached out? And the next thing you knew, you reached out. And I just said to you, I'm really sorry. I have no idea who you are. And I would really love to meet you. And we set up a date and time to have lunch. And that was the beginning of the first mother-daughter relationship I've ever had in my life. And
yeah,
I was 21.
Oh yeah, you were very young still. And yeah. you hadn't heard a lot of your dad's music because once your mother would not talk about him. I guess it was just too painful for her. And you knew very little about your dad until we connected. I remember the first time I sat down, I can still see it. I can see a lot of these things with you because they're so important. We sat down at the dining room table and I played you the International Submarine Band for the first time. I mean, yeah. those memories to me are so exquisite. And I'm glad we got to share those things. But then you got into your dad. It took a while because right? It took you a little while to really go there.
I couldn't go there. I didn't know how I would get out if I couldn't handle it. I didn't know. I was terrified because I could, you know, I just didn't know how to handle myself. I didn't know how to handle those feelings. I didn't know. I hadn't processed the grief. I hadn't processed not having a, you know, I was just a shit show, to be honest with you. I was angry and confused and lost and immature and ridiculous and just trying to survive. And then all of a sudden, oh, by the way, you're Graham Parsons' daughter, and you should probably know everything there is to know about Graham, because when you're asked a question, you need to be the authority. And I was like, oh, fuck no. I can't handle that. I can barely brush my teeth on a good day.
So, Polly.
It's true.
I remember you lived with me for a while there. There's so much more to say, but let's take a quick break and we'll be right back, dolls. All right, we're back. Polly.
I think deep down in my heart knew that I wasn't going to be willing to open that Pandora's box without a guide that was seriously authentic and vetted by my father. And mm-hmm. I knew it would, in my heart, I knew it would either be you or Emmy Lou. And those are the only two people I was going to take it from.
And
in the end, You are the two women that educated me the most at very different times in my life. Finally, I bonded with you forever and you raised me. And then in my later life, I finally got to bond with Emmylou and understand the other side of the woman in my father's life, the other important life partner to my father, which I truly believe is and will always be Emmylou.
I believe that was taking off. It was still early stages. They were falling in love. It was that period.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's stunningly beautiful and tragic and lovely and heartbreaking and what a beautiful body of love they gave to the world, you know, in their pairing, in their time together.
Well, why don't we hear one of their songs right now?
You know, the funny thing is that Dad is still playing on the radio for whatever reason at my house. So I'm listening to them, but let's do it.
Oh, Lord, stay with us. Won't you scratch my itch, sweet Annie Rich? Welcome me back to town. Come out on your porch, you step into your parlor, and I'll tell you how it all went down. Out with the truckers and the kickers and the cowboy angels, and a good saloon in every single town. Yes, and I remembered something you once told me, and I'd be damned if it did not come true.
Yes, they certainly sang well together. She could, you know, he wasn't an easy singer because he was so emotional. And I bet she had her voice was so pure and crystalline and all of that, that I'm sure, you know, she was able to follow his emotional voice, which I must admit it was pretty incredible.
I noticed, and I've also heard, but I can feel my dad now in a very different way when I watch him in video, and I can see him literally giving, you know, let me set this up a little better. So I'm a dancer and I love couples dancing, like tango and Argentinian tango and salsa. And it's a passionate thing that I've done for my whole life. Right. When you dance with a truly, truly gifted partner, they communicate with you through tiny movement pulsations through the palms of your hands. And that literally guides your entire body into a fully different move just by a fraction of a pressure of an inch into your palm.
Yes.
With that said, Dad would say that the minute he sat down with Emmylou and sang with her for the first time, all he had to do was lift his chin ever so slightly and she would go up in the note. And he would look at her in her eyes and widen his eyes, and she would know to go bigger. And how he taught her to harmonize was literally, she was completely automatically tied to his intuitional art, you know, that part of his artistry.
Well, you can hear it.
I just really jacked up that explanation.
No.
But in my heart, it made total sense.
I mean, I totally get it.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Oh. Gosh, we could. Well, I want to talk about your new venture. That's a really important thing. I want to hear all about it.
Oh, God. It's so exciting to me. Okay, so I don't even know where to start, to be honest with you. Sound as Ever. Sound as Ever is the name of this new project I'm working on. And it is literally a culmination of my entire life's work and my entire understanding of my lineage, past, present, and future with my father. It's part memoir, it's part, you know, Moroccan bazaar. It's just the most beautiful thing in the world. And basically, to put it succinctly, Sound as Ever is how Daddy used to sign off on his letters instead of using the word sincerely, right?
Exactly.
So he was very, very into handwritten letters. He would type them or he would handwrite them. And he was very prolific in his willingness to communicate back and forth via regular post.
Yes.
Well, he signed all of his handwritten letters, Sound as Ever, Graham.
Mm-hmm.
And that became the name of this new project I'm doing just absolutely naturally. And it just gives me a lump in my throat right now. But basically what it is Sound as Ever is an online marketplace. And there's goods that are basically divided into two parts. The first part are products that we or I have designed and created specifically for this company. The second part are beautiful, beautiful goods that have been designed and curated by me with artisans that we wanted to support. So artisans from all over the world that, you know me, I've always been drawn to things that very much have to do with how I grew up while my dad was alive, while Nancy was still healthy. I grew up on a commune, a lot of people don't know. And after Dad died, I moved to a place called Sunnybrook Farm in Santa Barbara. And I lived there for, you know, that was just part of my journey. My father was extremely nomadic. He loved to travel and share stories. He loved to bring a record player under his arm and a stack of records. Everyone talks about it, including Keith Richards and the Rolling Stones. I mean, Dad was just, he was a messenger, right?
Yes.
And so I knew in this next phase of my life that it was absolutely imperative for me to bond into my father's world in a way that not only felt communal to me, it felt right. And I feel this huge need of the people in my atmosphere, in my world, and all over the world to be more communicating with each other, to be more, to find a closeness and a commonality now more than ever. We're seeking community. We're starting to realize that all this separateness and all of this commercialism and you know, it's ringing really hollow now, more so than it ever has in the past.
Yes, I agree.
And I just started to really vibe with people that were making sound decisions for the planet, for each other, for their homes, that felt raw and authentic and organic. And they felt like, and we have a whole series in this, you know, marketplace that we've created with Sound as Ever called Items of Attunement, right? Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? It means that I don't want to just go out into the world of consumerism and just thrash stuff more for the sake of buying things. I want to purchase something that means something on multiple levels. If I'm going to spend money on it, I want it to have heart. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does.
And if I have that opportunity, forward. I'm not always going to have that opportunity.
Yeah.
But sometimes I will connect with somebody's vision. Hi, Daddy. Daddy is still playing on the radio.
That possible? What channel do you have on?
I think it must be my Spotify. So I guess the idea here is every single thing that I'm doing with this online marketplace not only gives back, right? Mm-hmm. Everything has a reason. Portions of everything goes back into the cycle of something else. Everything has intention, including, you know, the stuff that has to happen, like the packaging. I mean, I'm just trying to do something correct and right and from the heart. And it feels really good. And I'm writing my stories about Graham and Nancy and how they relate to the things that I chose.
Okay, good.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
The company.
Can you give me just like two examples of something that people will be able to buy on that website of yours?
Oh, I know it sounds so silly and trite, and it's so not. To me, there's so much love and depth to this. But one of the examples would be, you're gonna laugh at this probably, but that's okay. I'm really into atmosphere. I don't like overhead light. I'm very particular about, you know, how warm a room is atmospherically, not temperature.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. Like I'm pretty sure I get this from my dad, because our house, the house up on Mulholland or Laurel Canyon, whichever one that was, it was just always covered in like moss green velvet and just really, really warm amber candlelight everywhere. Like that's what I remember. Mm-hmm. So we created this really beautiful series of candles based on my sensory smell profiles from throughout my life. So like one of them is called Sunriser. Mm-hmm. And I based it on mornings in Laurel Canyon, right?
Nice.
Smell, right? The cannabis coming through the bedroom windows and the guitar, all the acoustic guitars you could hear throughout the canyon in the morning, and the sandalwood or the, you know, mom always had stargazer lilies everywhere. Yes. And so, right? So each candle is created from an amalgamation of scents that surrounded that world for us in the 70s or 60s. Mm-hmm. And then the vessel transforms after you're done with the candle into a series of really beautiful whiskey glasses.
Oh, nice.
Right?
Yeah.
And we were lucky enough to curate, I don't know if you know what whiskey stones are, but they're actual natural stones that are shaped into ice cubes, and you put them in the freezer and they don't water down your whiskey because they're rocks, right?
Nice.
We curated them from a quarry in Joshua Tree, like right outside the desert.
Very cool, so, honey.
Yeah, it's like, that's what I mean. Everything has meaning and depth, and it's very sensory gifting. It's more of an experiential thing, I guess, is what
I'm saying. Wow, I'm so proud of you, as always. Polly keeps, you know, she reinvents herself every few years. It's really quite a sight to behold, I'll tell you. And she's gorgeous, for those of you who don't know what she looks like. Honey, let's talk a little bit about the concert you did for your dad.
Okay.
Yeah. How did that, you know, come about? First of all, I want everybody to know about it. It's on DVD. Is it available for people to get?
Amazon. They can get it on. I think they can get it on Amazon still.
Okay.
It's called Return of the Grievous Angel.
Mm-hmm.
No. Return to Sin City.
Return to Sin City. Yeah.
Yeah. Return to Sin City.
And it's
a tribute to Graham Parsons.
A tribute to Graham Parsons and the people she lined up and the stories she could tell about that. I was her, in quotes, assistant at that event.
That's the only way they would let me get you off the credentials.
It was a two-night event at the Universal Amphitheater, right?
Universal Amphitheater and my hometown, the Santa Barbara Bowl.
And the Santa Barbara Bowl. And it was so amazing, this event. And of course, I had really great seats because I was Polly's assistant. And I remember, well, you tell the story, honey.
No, tell me what you remember.
I remember how hard you worked on it, how many hours you spent on the phone with Keith Richards, you know, person.
Jane is lovely.
I know, but I know she helped make it happen. But it took a lot of energy from you to get Keith Richards there.
Two
years of she worked on this show to she really wanted Keith there. And because
how could I possibly do it without Keith? I wasn't going to. Yeah. And you know, the funny part is that this was not an idea in my head until I was standing in front of him. I met him for the first time October 31st, 2003.
Yeah.
I had just done all of the healing around my father. I had gone to Joshua Tree. I had stayed in his room. I listened to all the records. I did all the journaling. I did all the therapeutic work around it. I was just ready to heal. And anyone that has had to do hard work around anything knows that that's kind of an onion peeling process. There's always more layers.
Yeah.
And the first layer is really hard and pretty crumbly and kind of gross. And then you go and you go deeper and you go deeper and you go deeper. And finally I got to this layer of the healing onion, I guess we can call it. And that layer was, all right, now you know who you are. Now you know what your job is, which is to correctly and respectfully perpetuate your father's legacy. You are his only true blood. You are his only child. And no one else is going to be able to do this the way you could. So you better step up. What are you going to do?
Yeah, I remember that real well when you said, okay.
Here we go.
This guy is my dad, man.
Yep. And I went from a shriveling, insecure wreck to owning it and going, how can I be of service to this man and his music?
Yep.
And the one thing I had noted while I had been avoiding my job in this way, my daughterhood in this way, was that no one had done a proper tribute that really encompassed everybody on a bigger scale than just a small venue tribute.
Yes.
So I thought, well, what the heck? I mean, what's the worst that can happen? I can try, I can fail, or I can try and it might work out. And I was at that point at a very high level of the career I was in. And I had just gotten the biggest promotion of my life. And I walked into my new boss and I said, with tears in my eyes, I am sorry, but I cannot work for you anymore because I need to do this. I need to do something and it's important and it's for my father and I have to leave. And he looked at me and went, I'm sorry, what? And I walked out that day and I picked up the phone and I thought, how am I going to reach anybody that would be willing, that would have the gravitas to make a tribute concert feel appropriately weighty? And I said, well, who would I want? I would want Dwight Yoakam, I would want Emmy Lou, I would want Keith Richards. I love Steve Earle. Lucinda Williams is genius. There's so many people influenced by dad. Yep. And so much of the music 15, 20 years ago was so heavily being tinged with so much grand magic. And now I had a full head of, I mean, I was his daughter my whole life and I knew that, but I was now ready. And so I thought, how am I going to find these people? So I picked up the phone and I called the Actors Union. And I said, my name's Polly Parsons and I'm a producer and I would like to cast Dwight Yoakam in a movie and I need his phone number. And she gave it to me. And I went, holy shit.
Well, that's who you are. You just, you make things happen. You don't think too much about it, really. You just
I don't know how smart that is.
You just say, okay, I'm going to do this. Right. I'm gonna make this happen. And it does, you know. It's you do, considering everything you've been through, you have a lot of self-love, self-belief, self-belief. Yeah, you do, honey. Otherwise, you couldn't accomplish the stuff you've done.
I don't think, you know what I think it is, though, sweetheart? I don't think it has anything to do with me personally. I think that I'm a curious spirit and I'm excited to try. You know what I mean? Like, I'm curious. I'm fucking curious.
Yeah.
What are they going to say? Who knows? Why don't you try? And so that world of those concerts just kept happening like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got a hold of Dwight Yoakam's people and I said, this is Polly. And I'm thinking about doing a tribute concert. I would love it if you would please just consider it. And they said, well, send us this, you know, a bunch of information about what you're thinking. And I hung up and went, I have no idea what I'm thinking. So I just kept putting one foot in front of the other. And the next thing you know, it got picked up by the blessed Moss Jacobs, who was that at that time, the lead producer of the Santa Barbara Bowl through Golden Voice. And he was a Graham fan and he thought I was just crazy enough to pull this off. And he got behind me and he didn't know me, you know, from Adam. And then because he believed, he got House of Blues to believe. And then Shyla, my sweet best friend from many, many years, we were high school mates together. And then, you know, it just, magic kept happening. And then finally it was time to ask Keith.
Yeah.
And I thought the only way this is going to work is if I get to meet him someday. And I got to meet him and his manager saved me as a surprise. I thought, I didn't know this, but he didn't know I was coming.
Oh, wow.
She trotted me in backstage and said, Keith, this is Graham Parsons' daughter, Polly. And he turned around and he made a beeline for me. And I was shocked because I just realized at that moment that he didn't know I was going to be there.
Oh.
He put my whole face in his hands and he pulled my face to his face and he said, you're the last little bit of Graham on the planet.
Oh.
He kissed me on the cheek.
I know. It was amazing that he showed up. I mean, and I know you had to have his dressing room and his hotel room all decorated like Morocco. And I remember him walking in and putting his fist up and saying, one love, one love to everybody. And I got to be right there because I was your assistant and it was an incredible experience. Now, and I want the people to know, I mean, there's a duet with Keith and Nora Jones, man, that you guys have to see. So if you guys aren't familiar with this amazing DVD, please seek it out. Produced by Polly Parsons, my goddaughter.
Yeah.
Beautiful goddaughter. And now her daughter, Harper Lee, is my great goddaughter. So, wow. It's a real honor to be able to say that.
Yeah, she's turning 16 next week.
I know.
It's just crazy talk. This is the first time I've ever, ever, ever spoken this like this on any form of anywhere. And I would never ever do this for anyone but Miss Pamela. But I do want to say that I apologize if I sound you know, like a sore sport. I don't mean to. Pamela and I could really, really get into so many chapters of this conversation.
Yes.
That would help you to understand more of the layers of the years and relationships and misfires and funny never happenings that turned us all into who we are today regarding the subject of Graham, Nancy, and their daughter Polly. But I don't want to sound by any means like I'm not incredibly touched and grateful and not acutely aware of the huge responsibility I have to be a voice and a person that loves and creates space for Graham's music to continue to grow. And I just want to make sure that I make that clear.
Well, why don't we hear, like, for instance, some of your favorites. One of them is $1,000 Wedding Dress. And I was there for that entire story.
That's fun. You and I could do this for a few weeks.
I know. I was there for that entire story. I know why that song was written. I know who it was written about. I know everything about it, but we're not going into that. But we're going to play it for people so we can hear one of Polly's favorite songs by her father, Graham Parsons, and the Flying Burrito Brothers.
Was $1,000 wedding supposed to be held the other day? And with all the invitations sent, the young bride went away. When the groom saw people passing notes, not unusual, he might say, but where are the flowers for my baby? I'd even like to see her mean old mama.
I love that song. It's just such an amazing true story. So in a nutshell, Graham and Nancy were set to get married, and Graham had Nancy's wedding dress made by Nudie's Rodeo Tailor.
Yep.
For $1,000.
That was a lot back then.
And it was a full white rhinestone Nudie gown.
Yeah.
And it they broke up just before the wedding, and what a tragic, tragic, sweet, sweet song that is.
Well, the reason that he called her from the road, see, I was sitting there. He called her from the road and said, I'm canceling the wedding dress. Right. And that's why she did what she did, which we don't need to talk about. And they broke up. But yeah, he called her from the road, and that was it. They broke up, and the wedding dress was never actually finished or anything.
No, but it does exist. From what I hear, it's in a vault somewhere, which is very, very exciting.
It really is?
I really do think it is.
Ooh.
Yeah, okay. I really do.
Well, while we're on the topic of Nancy, do you want to read that piece that you wrote in class?
Oh gosh, that's heavy. Are you sure
it gives a little insight into your difficult childhood.
Okay, guys, so here goes. I am a very, very happy human, just so you know that.
Yeah, this might sound a little different, but she is.
And, I really am.
Yeah.
I actually ended up being mildly well-adjusted, which is shocking.
I know, it's incredible.
Okay.
I think I had a part in that.
Yes, you did. You had a huge part in that, Miss Pamela. So this was the very first piece I ever wrote, and it just happened to be Miss Pamela invited me to a writing class in 2006 in Austin, Texas. And I showed up, and I literally didn't think I was going to be capable of staying through the whole thing. And this was the first prompt that she gave us was something about what was one of your most vivid memories.
And your childhood memories, yeah.
One of your most vivid childhood memories. And this is what I wrote. My mother is a geisha. Her hair is long and black. She wears it like a cloak of armor. It is her finest asset. She has a large chair that sits in every room of every home we have ever had. This is her chair. This is where she sits, judge, jury, and executioner. She is highly skilled at the art of the pleasure of men. She is royalty and demands respect and high praise from all who enter her atmosphere. Like small planets, whooshing by an absorbent sun. I can smell her sleeping from the darkness under her bed where I lay. I yearn to touch her, to be close to her, to feel her warmth, but I am not allowed. So I wait, counting the cinder blocks that make up the base of her sleeping chamber. I am covered in old sheets. I can smell her perfume. Picture the red and blue of the midnight Chinese silk that caresses her skin. Morning comes, and while she can't hear me, I crawl up on the bed to be near her beauty. My father is a distant sadness, a fallen warrior of the highest honor. And my mother mourns his death above my life. And so it is. Ragged and worn, shredded and tattered, alone and forgotten, now my mother waits to die. Long gone are her opportunities to have mastered an art form worth having. Strangely, she sits alone under her bed that she made from the silk that once was the excrement of worms.
Polly, that still gives me chills. I just had chills all up and down.
All up and down?
Yeah. Yes. And I know that, I've heard it many times now, and it's just so beautiful and so, the visuals, you know, since I know her, of course, and knew her then and everything. But even the people who wouldn't know who she is or anything about it could picture those. It was just exquisite, honey.
Thank you, sweetheart. And I really appreciated how detached I was, because that's a true story. I did sleep under her bed. I was not allowed to sleep with her I had a skin condition. But anyway, so all of that is a true story. Yeah. So I really appreciated the fact that I didn't feel pain when I wrote it.
Yeah.
I felt like an onlooker and somebody that would survive her.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's you were reflecting on the past, but you also allowed yourself, like I demand in class, to get your ego out of the way and let this stuff channel through. I mean, which you are able to do. You're always able to do that in your writing. And maybe it's because you've had to be out of body sometimes.
An observer.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when I went to therapy a few times when I was young, the therapist looked at me and she said, "You're one of the 1%. And I said, "What is the 1%? And she said, "We have found through studies that there's 1% of children that go through the level of trauma that you went through, and the 1% that survives into adulthood and actually thrives, they all have one thing in common, and that is they never, for whatever reason, took the abuse personally."
Wow.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yes.
They never turned it inward and said, "This is my fault. If I was better, you would love me different."
Right.
It never dawned on me to do that. Like, I would look at all of this stuff that was going on around us and I'd go, "Okay, you're fucked up. I need to go ahead and remove myself from this situation."
Eventually. No.
I mean, situationally, like I never.
Yeah. Yeah.
And went,
yeah.
"Oh, you're abusing me because I'm a bad girl." So I guess it's just a luck of the draw, but I really find that fascinating. And I love it when people hear we can do hard things. We can do
hard things. And you've done a lot of hard things. We all have. Yes. And yeah, you're thriving. Well, all humans go through that. It's what we have to do to get better at being who we are.
Well, that is so very true. And another thing that I always say, and I mean this with all my heart, pain doesn't get more painful. Mm. Your pain, my pain, it's the same pain.
Yes. Yes.
Every listener out there is a courageous warrior that has gone through the exact same level of pain. It's just that our stories have different chapters,
but yes, the theme exactly. Yeah.
That resonates off the page of all of our stories is the same pain.
Yep.
And we get to, you know, we get to start anew and try again and stay curious and
staying curious. So important. Yeah.
It's all important. And I love you, and I'm gratefully embarrassed because I've never done this before. So I feel like a schmuck.
What are you talking about? We're having a conversation. It's a very lovely one, darling. In fact, I'm going to tell a little anecdote about your mom before we close here. Your mom always thought that she and Graham were too young, that she shouldn't call him her old man like everybody did back then. This is my old lady, this is my old man. So she called Graham her old boy. Aww. And it made it into Hot Burrito 1.
It sure did. I love that song so much.
I'm your toy. I'm your old boy. I mean, I can, it makes me cry. I mean, it's unbearable.
Unbearable.
I know. So we're going to end with that song.
I hope this wasn't sad podcast. I want it to be happy. I want us to go out of this podcast remembering you and your circle skirt swaying back and forth at the Whiskey-A-Go-Go, watching beautiful, lengthy, long, brunette, gorgeous Graham sing Hot Burrito 1.
Okay. It was pretty beautiful. He sat at the piano and sang this, and it was just with those fingers, with those hands, the most beautiful hands on earth. Polly got them. Honey, what is the name of your website so everybody can go to it?
Oh my God, so exciting. The website address is actually weareSoundAsEver.com, spelled all the way out. weareSoundAsEver.com. We are sound as ever.
We are sound as ever. Yeah. Okay, everyone. This is Hot Burrito 1.
We love you.
Thank you, Polly, my darling.
Thank you, Miss Pamela. Thank you for being such a genius light in this world for all of us. Thank you, honey, for your raw, authentic love.
Okay. I have a lot of it for you, baby.
I have a lot of it for you too, baby. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Wasn't that just spectacular? You guys, I'm sure you had an amazing time listening to Polly and me reminisce. she shared with you today stuff she has never spoken about in public. And I'm really grateful to her for that. And I have a few things going on. You know, I do rock and roll tours. I have one coming up December 4th, so you can sign up for it. I do them every few weeks. My website is PamelaDeBarOfficial.com, and I sell my books, lots of photos, certain vintage items and necklaces. You know, I go nuts on there. So please visit me at PamelaDeBarOfficial.com and buy all my books. You should start with I'm with the Band. That's the first one I wrote. And it was a big New York Times bestseller for many months. So it's still out there. So please read it. And thank you so much for listening to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party.
You've been listening to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party, produced by Aaron Alden and Christian Swain. All sound design by Jerry Danielson and Busy Signal Studios. Find Miss Pamela at Pamela DeBar on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Find all the Pantheon podcasts at pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you find great podcasts. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/pantheonpodcasts. Rock and Roll Archaeology on Instagram and Pantheon Pods on Twitter.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.